I never thought working at a five-star resort like Coral Cove would be anything but peaceful. The pristine beaches, the turquoise waves, and the rich guests. It was supposed to be a dream job. But there's something no one tells you about working in luxury hotels. The corridors, the rooms, the hidden corners, they all have their secrets. I've cleaned enough suites to know that the most beautiful places can hide the darkest things. I was on the night shift when they checked in, room 803, a mother and daughter, Elizabeth and Lily. They arrived like any other guests. Elizabeth was elegant, the kind of woman who spoke with a soft confidence, and her daughter, Lily, was, well, different. Something about her put me on edge from the start. She didn't look at her mother when she spoke, always glancing away, fidgeting like something was eating her up inside. I wouldn't have paid them much mind if it weren't for the strange request they made the same evening. Around midnight, just as I was finishing up my rounds, Lily came down to the front desk. She was with a man, a stranger, tall, with dark eyes that felt too calm. His name was Marcus, and he was Lily's boyfriend. They were hushed, whispering to the receptionist. The two of them wanted an extra key for room 803 without Elizabeth knowing. That didn't sit right with me. I tried to shrug it off. Guests do weird things all the time. The next morning, I was assigned to clean their room. When I knocked, no one answered. Standard procedure is to go in if no one's around, so I unlocked the door. What greeted me was a mess. A broken fruit bowl, glass shards scattered across the floor, and a sickly sweet smell that turned my stomach. I've cleaned enough rooms to know the scent of death, even when it's masked by expensive perfume. I wasn't prepared for what I found. The suitcase, a big black one, sitting by the edge of the bed. As I approached, the smell intensified, and my heart started racing. Something was leaking from the bottom, a dark, sticky liquid. My hands shook as I reached for the zipper, but before I could even touch it, Lily walked in. Her eyes were wide and frantic. Behind her was Marcus, calm as ever, like the storm hadn't touched him at all. They froze when they saw me standing by the suitcase.
What are you doing here?
Lily's voice trembled.
I was just cleaning.
I stammered, my gaze darting between them and the suitcase.
I didn't touch anything.
Marcus stepped forward, blocking my path to the door. His eyes were cold, too cold for someone so young. You need to leave. Nodding, I slowly backed away.
I'll come back later.
Lily looked like she was going to cry. Her hands were trembling as she fiddled with the hem of her shirt. I wanted to reach out, to ask if she was okay, but Marcus's presence stopped me. He didn't say another word, just watched me with that unsettling stillness as I slipped out of the room and into the hallway. I didn't breathe until I was far away, tucked into a storage closet where I could pull myself together. My mind raced. Something horrible had happened in that room. I could feel it, sense it. And whatever was in that suitcase, it wasn't luggage. I rushed to tell my supervisor, but by the time we got back to room 803, it was too late. The suitcase was gone, and so were Lily and Marcus. The room was eerily clean, as if nothing had ever been out of place. But I knew better. I'd seen it. I'd smelled it. Elizabeth was gone, and I had a sinking feeling I knew where she was. Hours later, the resort was buzzing. Security footage showed the couple leaving with the suitcase, handing it off to a taxi driver who didn't know what he was carrying. They were found a few hours later, hiding in a cheap motel across town, arrested. Lily cried when they cuffed her, but Marcus didn't flinch. He just stared straight ahead, as if none of it mattered. Within hours, it was all over the news of how a greedy daughter killed her own mother with the help of her psycho boyfriend. Elizabeth had been wealthy, very wealthy. Her husband, Lily's father, had passed away not too long ago, leaving behind a large inheritance. But Elizabeth held tight to it, refusing to give Lily and Marcus any of it until Lily was older, more responsible, she'd said. And that's where Marcus came in. He didn't care about responsibility, he wanted the money, and he wanted it fast. Together, they'd planned it out. Lily lured her mother to Bali under the guise of a bonding trip, while Marcus followed days later. Elizabeth never saw it coming. I couldn't sleep that night. The image of that suitcase and Elizabeth's bloodied body lying inside it haunted me as the weight of what I almost opened pressed onto my chest. I tried to forget, to push it out of my mind, but some things stick with you. The whispers in the hallways, the way the air felt colder after they left, it was like the hotel itself was holding onto that darkness. Even now, years later, I can't shake the memory of that night. I still work at Coral Cove, and every time I pass room 803, I get a chill. It's strange how paradise can turn into a nightmare so quickly, how easily people can hide the worst parts of themselves behind smiles and luxury. I've cleaned countless rooms since then, but I'll never forget that smell, that suitcase, and the cold, dead eyes of Marcus and Lily. Sometimes I wonder if the island remembers too. It was 20 years ago when I spent a summer at my grandparents' home in rural Wyoming. Their house sat near a serene lake, its water so calm that they mirrored the sky perfectly. As a city kid, the vast open spaces and the quiet nights were both exhilarating and a bit unsettling. Soon after my arrival, I made friends with some local kids around my age. There was Tom, with his mischievous grin, and Lisa, who was always up for an adventure. One afternoon, they introduced me to a peculiar game they'd invented. It involved one kid sitting on a plastic chair by the lake while another slapped the chair's back with a dusty cloth, building up static electricity. When someone touched the kid in the chair, a sharp jolt would spark, sending us all into fits of laughter. Eager to fit in, I took my turn on the chair. As Tom vigorously slapped the cloth against the seat, I felt the static beneath me build. Lisa reached out and tapped my arm, but instead of the quick shock I expected, a surge of energy coursed through me, and my vision blurred. Colors intensified, and the world around me took on a surreal, almost dreamlike quality. I blinked rapidly, trying to steady myself. That's when I saw them. Figures around the lake's edge that hadn't been there before. Men and women dressed in old-fashioned clothing, their faces pale and eyes distant. Some stood motionless, gazing across the water, while others walked slowly along the shore. The vision lasted only a few seconds before fading away, leaving me disoriented.
"Did you guys see that?"
I asked, my voice shaky.
"See what?"
Tom replied, exchanging a puzzled look with Lisa.
"The people by the lake,"
I insisted.
"They were right there." I think the static got to your head, Jack.
Embarrassed, I dropped the subject. But later, as we parted ways, a quiet boy named Ethan approached me. He'd been on the outskirts of our group, rarely speaking.
"I believe you," he said softly.
"You do?"
Relief washed over me.
"I've seen them too. They're not real. Not like us. They're spirits."
"Spirits?"
I echoed, skeptical yet intrigued. Ethan glanced around to ensure we were alone.
"Meet me here tomorrow after everyone leaves. I'll show you."
The next day, once the others had gone, Ethan and I returned to the lake with the plastic chair. My heart pounded as I sat down. He slapped the cloth against the chair, and when he touched my shoulder, the jolt was immediate. The world shifted again. This time, the spectral figures were clearer. Dozens of them dotted the shoreline. Some were wailing silently, mouths open in expressions of agony. Others trudged along, heads bowed. One woman in a tattered dress wept as she clutched something invisible to her chest. I tried to call out to them, but they didn't react.
"They can't hear us," Ethan said. "They're trapped here. People who drown in the lake."
A chill ran down my spine.
"How do you know this?" "My grandfather told me stories. Said the lake holds memories of those who've died in it."
The vision faded, and we were left standing by the tranquil waters. An uneasy silence settled between us. That evening, back at my grandparents' house, I was unusually quiet. My grandmother noticed. Her solution was feeding me more chicken soup. I lay in bed, the images of the spirits replaying in my mind. Sleep eluded me. Just as I began to drift off, a soft tapping at my window startled me. I sat up, heart racing. Ethan's face peered through the glass.
"We need to go back,"
he whispered when I opened the window.
"Now? It's the middle of the night. I think we can learn more. Please."
Against my better judgment, I agreed. We slipped away into the cool night, the moon casting an ethereal glow over everything. At the lake's edge, we set up the chair once more. The stillness was unsettling.
You go first.
I sat down, and he repeated the ritual. As the jolt coursed through me, the surroundings transformed. The spirits were back, but this time, they were different. Their faces were sharper, their eyes glowing faintly, and they were all looking directly at us.
Ethan,
I whispered, fear creeping into my voice.
They see us.
He swallowed hard.
We should leave.
Before we could move, the spirits began to advance. They moved unnaturally, gliding over the ground without moving their legs. A low murmur filled the air, like a distant lament carried on the wind.
Run!
We bolted along the shoreline, the spirits in pursuit. The once familiar path became treacherous all of a sudden. I stumbled over rocks and roots, my breath coming in ragged gasps. The wailing grew louder, pressing in from all sides. I glanced back and saw one of the spirits mere feet behind me, its hand outstretched. Its eyes were hollow, darkness swirling within. Panic surged, propelling me forward.
Over here!
Ethan called, veering towards a small footbridge that spanned a narrow stream feeding into the lake. We dashed across, and as we reached the other side, the spirits halted abruptly at the water's edge, unable to follow. We collapsed onto the grass, chest heaving. The spirits stood silently before slowly receding back toward the lake, eventually fading into the night.
I am not doing that again.
Ethan nodded solemnly. We parted ways, each sneaking back into our homes. The next morning, neither of us spoke of what happened. The rest of my stay passed uneventfully, but an unspoken understanding lingered between us. Years later, I still think about that summer. The images remain vivid, and I can't help but feel a twinge of guilt, as if our curiosity disturbed the souls at peace. I've never returned to that lake, but sometimes, in the quiet moments before sleep, I hear the faint echo of their silent wails. I had always cherished the rare moments when our family could escape the bustle of daily life. So, when I heard about the historic Venetian villa that had been converted to an Airbnb, which was available for a weekend stay at eye-watering prices, it seemed like the perfect retreat. The villa, though aged, possessed a certain charm with its faded frescoes and ivy-clad walls whispering secrets of bygone eras. My husband, our three children, and I arrived on a crisp autumn afternoon. The setting sun casting golden hues over the ancient stone. I found it odd that there wasn't much staff, nor was the villa in a pristine condition. A property manager showed us around, then handed the keys. As we settled in, the children darted through the grand hallways, their laughter echoing off marble floors. I followed them into a dimly lit parlor, where a grand piano stood in solitary grandeur. Its ebony surface bore the scars of time. Scratches marred its once lustrous finish, and several keys were chipped or missing. Drawn to it, I couldn't resist running my fingers over the ivory keys. I was a music teacher myself, who had a dream of one day becoming a maestro, but life had other plans. Despite its disrepair, I coaxed a few soft notes that echoed eerily through the silent halls. That evening, as we gathered for dinner, an unusual hush fell over the children. They picked at their food, eyes distant.
Are you feeling all right?
I asked, but they merely nodded. Later, as I tucked them into bed, I heard them humming unfamiliar melodies in their sleep, complex compositions far beyond their years. A shiver ran down my spine, but I dismissed it as remnants of the day's excitement. The next day, my husband grew uncharacteristically distant. He sat by the window, tapping his fingers rhythmically on the sill as if playing an invisible instrument.
What tune is that?
I inquired gently. He glanced at me with a vacant stare. Just something stuck in my head, he murmured before turning back to the window. The villa's previous owner was a brilliant but tormented composer named Alessandro Verdi, obsessed with creating the perfect symphony to bridge the mortal world and the afterlife. His fixation led to madness. He died in that mansion, his magnum opus unfinished. Suddenly, I heard the piano, but as I rushed to the room, there was no one. That night, a storm raged outside. The villa seemed to come alive with the music. I woke up to find my husband missing. Then, I ventured into my kids' room, and they were gone as well. I rushed to the hall in panic, but there I found them swaying like sleepwalkers, eyes glazed, each drawn to different walls while the piano played its music. Panic gripped me as I called out to them, but they remained unresponsive. Desperate and terrified, I ran through the winding hallways hoping to find a help, but my own shadow seemed to outrun me and then move on its own. Doors slammed shut behind me, and the air grew thick with the scent of old parchment and candle wax. I stumbled back into the parlor where the grand piano stood. To my astonishment, the room was transformed. The piano appeared restored. That is when the realization struck me. Verdi's spirit was in turmoil, his magnum opus unfinished. Music might be the key to appeasing him. With trembling hands, I sat at the piano, drawing upon my own skills and the haunting memories my children had hummed. I began to weave together the fragments of the unfinished symphony. The notes flowed seamlessly, guided by a force beyond my understanding. The music swelled, filling the villa with a hauntingly beautiful composition that resonated with sorrow and longing. As I played the final chord, a profound silence enveloped the villa. The oppressive atmosphere lifted, and the shadows receded into the walls. My husband and children blinked, finally waking up, confusion clouding their faces. "What happened?" my husband asked, his eyes searching mine.
"I think it's over,"
I whispered, relief washing over me. The restored piano faded back into its dilapidated state. The air was clear and still, the storm outside calming to a gentle rain. The next morning, we hastily packed our belongings, eager to leave the villa behind. As we loaded the car, I glanced back one last time. For a fleeting moment, I think I saw a figure standing at an upper window, a man with a gentle smile. Then, he faded away, leaving only the ancient stone facade.